Today, for our 100th episode of the Nature and Nurture podcast and first in-person recording, I'm joined by a very special guest, my own PhD supervisor, Dr. Leah Somerville. Leah is the Grafstein Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard University, where she directs the Affective Neuroscience and Development Lab. Leah, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Adam.
We study adolescent brain development, and adolescence is an interesting age range because it's kind of this social, moral, legal gray area between childhood and adulthood. How did you become interested in that?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I think my inspiration to be excited about understanding development and specifically during this phase of life comes sort of from two different angles, one more scientific and one more personal. The scientific one is just the general fascination that I have with how people transform to become independent operators in society and in their environments, going from someone who's dependent and lacks certain skills and strategies and knowledge to someone who can, you know, exist independently in the world. That transformation fascinates me just from a basic science standpoint of what sort of is under the hood that allows a person to gain these competencies and independence, but also that there's, during this time of life, people kind of end up on trajectories that can be somewhat unpredictable. So some people can navigate this transition very successfully, others can have problems, and we don't always know in advance who's going to be who. If we did, we could sort people into high and low risk early in life, but we can't do that with much precision. So what kind of places people on those trajectories? And whether we can bend and shift those trajectories is a question that is always really interesting to me scientifically and from a sort of health and wellness perspective. More personally, I've also been excited about understanding adolescence since I myself was an adolescent, as somebody who had some of the characteristic stereotypical kinds of behaviors and emotions and experiences that made this time of life a very powerful and somewhat challenging one for me. And so kind of I've always been sort of interested in trying to unpack, like, what was it that happened during that time that was so impactful and so intense sort of for me and many, many others who have similar experience.
This all places nature and nurture at center stage because there are these age-related changes in experience and environment, and then there are a whole bunch of biological hormonal changes happening during puberty. I've been joking that my awkward teen years were so bad that it forced me to study, devote a whole PhD to studying how your hormones mess with your brain.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I think there are certainly biological cascades that happen during this adolescent transition, some of which hinge on pubertal changes, that underneath that lives changes in hormones and brain changes as well, which are fairly poorly understood still. And then we also have a person transforming within an environment and context that really has different demands on them than existed in childhood. So people are forming their own sort of self-generated peer groups. People are starting to face like real life challenges like educational, scholastic, and sort of more social challenges that they are navigating more independently than ever before. And also, you know, adolescence is a time where people are really forming their own identities and starting to affiliate with different belief systems, different groups of people, and sort of understanding themselves with more clarity. So these are all happening at once, right? We have the very rooted biological changes, and we have all of these more sociocultural changes and expectations that are placed on adolescents fresh, that they don't have a lot of experience navigating. But I would just also say that these things don't operate separately. They mm-hmm. also interact. So, for example, shifts in life stress can actually alter the trajectory of puberty and hormonal changes by accelerating or delaying them. They can also, it can also flip the other direction, where having a sort of early physical changes of puberty relative to one's peers can change the way that people are treated in social contexts, and therefore the sort of social world and environment can be also influenced by the biological changes as well. So there's sort of this these roots, I think, that are accurate the way you describe them, but then we also have to respect the fact that they interact as well.
Yeah, the interactions are so interesting, especially for puberty, which has come up a lot in our research. I didn't originally know about how susceptible puberty was to all these environmental exposures, like stress or even diet or sleep levels can influence pubertal timing. And then pubertal timing, as you mentioned, in turn, especially for girls, if your body's changing earlier, it might change the types of attention you get from peers or adults. And then that added stress can lead to a whole psychological cascade of events.
Right. That's exactly right. And that's part of the reason, I think, why understanding puberty in a vacuum or social changes in a vacuum has inherent limits in research.
As you know, Leah, I tend to gravitate towards evolutionary theories of human behavior. And it's interesting to me that you see this sort of stress model both at the cross-species level and within species. So across species, you see that if you're more of like a fast-moving species where the likelihood that your offspring doesn't survive is very high, like insects are the most extreme example of this. You're laying thousands of eggs and most of them die, but enough survive that you can propagate over time. And then mammals kind of take the opposite strategy where you have relatively few offspring, long gestational periods, a lot of investment, but most of them survive. And within a species, within humans, you see that same dynamic of more environmental stress means earlier puberty, more risky sex strategies, more likelihood, more like a high risk, high reward orientation in general. Whereas if you're raised with more stability, you have this slow delay of gratification, marshmallow test type thing.
Mm-hmm. Right, and part of that could be the kinds of experiences that you're exposed to. But I think it's really interesting to think about puberty and adolescence as a period of human life that's meant to prepare a person for independence, right? Like the whole purpose of this transition is to come, sort of emerge with the capacity to operate independently. And the fundamental idea behind these stress effects is that maybe an individual experiencing quite a lot of life stress in a family context would benefit from being able to, you know, reach those milestones and become independent earlier. It may be a protective factor. Now, that's just a theory. It's just an idea. It's something that I think researchers may or may not ever be able to sort of say why this pattern exists, but is actively uncovering sort of what it is that stress does to accelerate development. I think, though, that the research on that has some equivocal findings as well. So I think it might be more straightforward in other species than in people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But even within early development, we know that the brain is much more plastic. It's much more malleable to different demands based on environmental change or changes in experience. But there are certain critical windows where it's especially sensitive to different types of inputs. And we know a lot about basic sensory and motor processes having critical periods very early in development across species. Mm-hmm. And then more recently, I think it's been argued that adolescence is a second critical period of brain development. Can we talk about that?
Sure. So just to offer up a definition, the definition of a critical period would be one in which the brain's receptivity to some kind of environmental input is essential to develop that system. So just as an example, if you take any mammalian species and rear them completely in the dark, either the environment is perfectly dark or you would limit their vision through physical barriers on their eyes, the visual system fails to develop. Like a person could have a completely typical brain, but in the absence of that input, they would never learn to see. And it's because the light and visual inputs are actually in training the developing system, so that makes it critical. It's like essential that the system won't develop without it. That is in sort of contrast with what people call sensitive periods, which are periods of life where the brain is more than average or more than typically sensitive to a particular type of input. That is, that maybe the system would develop without it, but it would be shifted and shaped by some kinds of inputs and sculpted differently. And so we think, I think there's research suggesting that human adolescence may be a critical or sensitive period, depending on who you talk to or what kind of evidence you would need to call something critical versus sensitive. It's sort of a whole rabbit hole we don't have to go into, but there it is there. But in any case, it's a sensitive window for things like habits related to addiction. So the initiation of substance use tracks through the earlier it occurs during adolescence, the more chronic and severe it will be throughout one's own lifetime. For certain forms of social development, and I'm trying to think of other domains in which it's been argued that adolescence is a sensitive period. It could be a sensitive period for pretty much everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
But those are ones where it's been sort of linked with hard data that I know of.
I know some rodent studies on social behavior and play, where if you're deprived of socialization during a particular window of rodent adolescence, then you won't see the frontal cortex develop properly. But if you have the exposure, even at a young age or an older age, so again, pointing to a critical period where, or at least sensitive period, mm-hmm. where if it's not during this proper window, and moreover, the window seems to be triggered by hormonal changes during puberty. So like if you put the rodents on puberty blockers or castrate them, then the critical window doesn't really open, and then you can force it to open by administering other sorts of sex hormones.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that has impacts both on brain development as well as social behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Like the work of Cheryl Sisk and others with the Syrian hamster populations. That's a lot of research has been done there, modifying the pubertal hormone cascade and finding, for example, that lacking testosterone during this period has long-term impacts on an individual's place in their social hierarchy, consistently sort of having them at lower points of the hierarchy. And this has been causally attributed to lacking the testosterone. So I think that that's right, that there are hormonal pathways that might be opening plasticity, that then social behavior is just one example, can be sort of entrained differently depending on the brain's sort of sensitivity or receptivity to those experiences.
This would be a great place to talk more broadly about the role of animal research informing neuropsychology research, because especially with what we're studying, puberty and hormones and
mm-hmm.
brain development,
yeah.
these aren't things you can manipulate in humans, but with rodents, they're doing all sorts of crazy stuff like castrating them or pumping them full of opposite sex hormones and just seeing what happens.
Right. So in humans, there's a fundamental limit to almost all brain research, really, which is hinges on the fact that we don't manipulate the developmental process of people. Period. We don't alter their brains. We don't randomly assign them to conditions of, any kind of medication intervention. We don't randomly assign babies to families or environments, right? So we have to study development as it unfolds naturally, and we can look for associations between the age or developmental changes that we see in a person and the kinds of other measures we can take and sort of naturally observe, like their hormone levels or their environments. But just like you said, this limits the kinds of inferences that we can make in human research, right? We have to talk about things being associated rather than one causing another. We can use longitudinal studies to try and get slightly closer to a causal inference, and so what some people might call it is like quasi-causal inferences, where we could say that knowing something about a person at one time point can predict what something else about that person at a later time point. That still isn't causal because we did not manipulate anything and measure something, but it would indicate that something is a sort of precursor to something else, which many scientists would at least allow us to speculate about causality in that context. So this is where animal research becomes really important, because we are able to do research that has more invasive methods, and that allows for causal inferences to be made because individuals be randomly assigned to different different kinds of interventions. And by intervention, what I mean is there could be some sort of manipulation of brain, the brain, brain either circuitry, chemistry, right, the hormonal influences and so on, or one could manipulate their environments or the demands placed on them and see how that causally would change as well. So long story short, I think animal research is essential for our understanding of the pathways that occur across puberty and brain development and the relationships between them and behaviors. Now, I should also just mention, though, that the vast majority of animal research that we're talking about right now is in rodent models. And rodent models are great because they have puberty just like humans do, right? The hormonal cascades are very similar. But we also know that their brains are very different, right? There are certain kinds of brain systems, brain circuitry, as well as complex behaviors that are challenging to study in those populations, just based on the fact that they're rodents and we're not. The environmental demands that rodents have for like exploration and foraging for food and the way that they live in social groups is also different. And so there are also some limits to generalizability between human and rodent research, but it's sort of having both, you could think of it as having a bunch of puzzle pieces that can each contribute to the overall picture. And none of them is sufficient, but they can kind of add up to something more than any individual tool or level of analysis could.
Another quasi-causal research method in humans is twin studies. I don't know if you've done any twin studies, Leah, but I know that the big ABCD adolescent brain and cognitive development study has a massive oversampling of twins, which we could talk about, or any past research if you have done so.
Yeah, I have not done twin studies myself. But just to kind of provide a little background about the logic of twin studies and why they're special in psychology, twin studies are thought, and they're, you can always like come up with the exception to the rule, but in general, we can think of twin studies as being useful because it would indicate people, like a pair of twins is scientifically interesting because identical twins have identical or almost identical genes, right? Mm-hmm. And most twins are also reared in the same household, which would indicate that there's some like high level of similarity in the environment that they're reared in. And you could compare individuals with a sort of genetic, like identical genetics, or fraternal twins who only share half roughly of their genetics versus and are essentially siblings versus two people who are unrelated genetically but may also have been raised in the same household. Alternatively, very rarely, but it exists that some twins would be reared apart. And so that then would sort of pull apart environmental impacts. Now, twin studies can provide, like you said, some quasi-causal inferences to be made because you can try to isolate the shared environment or shared genes or a combination of both across a population of twins.
Mm-hmm. And especially for the twins reared apart, you see remarkable similarity. And in fact, the similarity grows over time. So this would be like maybe an epigenetic effect of self-selection into an environment that is more in line with like your initial genetic predisposition.
That's interesting. I'm not that versed in that kind of
well, so like on some personality measures, adopted children become more like their genetic parents over time and less like their adoptive parents over mm-hmm. time, even though what you would think based on like socialization is the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. Maybe you start off with the genetic piece and then you become socialized into your adoptive parents. But it seems like there's this epigenetic pathway where like you have these initial genetic differences, but then, you know, maybe you're like slightly more shy and timid mm-hmm. during childhood. And so that's a small effect. And then you realize that academia is a thing. So you like lean in full force to that and go full on nerd like you and I did. And then, so those initial differences can magnify over time.
That's interesting. I mean, I could imagine that being a product of the environment sort of cycling back on itself and specializing a person as a product of those experiences.
Yeah, so so this is another example of that classic interaction where it's definitely not just genes or environment.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But my own research has been going in the direction of risk and reward processing, and to oversimplify a big theory that I know has some limitations, and we can talk about those as well. Mm-hmm. There's this dual systems model of risk-taking during adolescence, and you could define impulsivity as a function between A, how strong the reward signal is, holding your inhibition constant, so greater reward means more willingness to take risk, and conversely, you could hold the reward constant and say lower inhibition means more likely to take a risk. And what we know about the neurodevelopment of these systems, reward systems tend to be subcortical, more evolutionarily ancient limbic brain regions, which mature earlier, and top-down inhibition is more cortical regions that mature later in development. And one theory for the stereotype of why teenagers are big risk takers is that the reward regions are maturing earlier and sending out full strength reward signals, whereas the inhibitory control regions mature more slowly. So you get sort of this big gap, which is thought to explain some of the increase in risk taking. But I know we've had many back and forths about this, about is it even true that teenagers are bigger risk takers than adults, or is this just a big stereotype?
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of layers there. So I can maybe comment on a couple of them. One is that I think there is some general truth to this framework. In other words, I think that the way that the brain develops is not along one and only trajectory, that different brain systems and regions and the interactions between them and other regions develop along different timelines in human development. So we have earlier and later developing systems. And I think of that as most importantly manifesting in connections and cross-communication among brain areas, rather than like how strongly active one area, single area would be. So the brain does develop along a host of different timelines. The timeline for the sort of most sophisticated executive processes around things like planning, complex decision making, weighing costs and benefits, and arriving at a sort of behavioral choice as a product of those, and a number of other sort of higher order cognitive functions tend to require more time to incubate and for experience to sculpt the brain. And that, I think, would broadly include something we might call like self-control or behavioral control. And so I think given that, it such a brain sort of late developing pattern of brain development could lead an individual very understandably to make a set of choices about their day-to-day actions and their plans for life and so on, with a sort of different weights on the costs and benefits. And this is also maybe a product of experience of sort of having the sort of wisdom or kind of behavioral experiences that would allow a person to make a reasoned choice based on a set of sort of assumptions or priors about how the world works. And so I think all of these factors are sort of, you could lump into the sort of like cognitive bucket of what might make an adolescent arrive at a set of behavioral choices that's different on average from adults. There's also, though, in this dual systems framework, reference to reward sensitivity. That is, like, for a given unit of reward, let's say I'm going to gift you a dollar, how much would that drive the choices that you would make toward obtaining it? Like, how driven are you to get it, and what would you be willing to give up, and how quickly and sort of impulsively might you approach and go toward that thing without necessarily sort of incorporating like the broader context or more nuanced information about its value relative to other options. And so this sort of impulsive reward seeking is something that has received a lot of scientific attention in the study of adolescence, and has been pinned as one of the most important factors that could lead an adolescent toward taking impulsive risks, right? Toward like, you know, I don't know, just as a toy example, like going out with your friends until late at night instead of doing your homework, or worse, mm-hmm. right? Like substance abuse or risky sexual behaviors. So I certainly think that brain development contributes in some way toward shifting the weights placed on different potential behaviors and outcomes, and that reward might be sort of overweighted relative to other factors that a person could, you know, use to make a decision about how to act in a given situation. I believe, maybe more than some scientists in this area, that it doesn't, though, boil down simply to how active a small set of particular brain regions are in this age range. I think that the story is much more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
And you also had mentioned whether or not adolescents are heightened risk takers. There is like a lot of epidemiological research that suggests that this time of life is a heightened one in terms of certain forms of impulsive risk taking, including the initiation of substance use. The thing that I think varies depending on what you would consider a risky behavior, like what you're, how you're operationalizing or like defining it, is that many of these behaviors we're talking about that we would consider risky behaviors really peak in their expression in later points of adolescence than you might expect. Like we might all envision like, oh yeah, those like 14-year-olds or 15-year-olds or 13-year-olds are doing all the risks, but actually it's a few years later. And I think that also kind of reminds us that having access to risk-enabling situations and also lack of familial adult oversight is another factor that influences risk-taking. That is like, how easy is it for you to take a risk?
Mm-hmm.
I think in the later parts of this adolescent phase, people have a lot more independence. Many of them don't even live at home anymore. They're in college or outside of the house, or maybe even living on their own. And so it's understandable that maybe the rates of engaging in certain things we would consider risky behaviors would go up simply also due to the availability of them in their mm-hmm. daily lives.
Right. So there's like this counterfactual of, if the 13-year-old had as much freedom as the 17-year-old,
yeah.
would they be the riskier one? Or is the 17-year-old, for like brain reasons,
yeah.
Have that heightened reward
right.
sensitivity as well?
Right, and that's where like experimental research can help fill in the puzzle, because we could provide the access to taking a risk in research, right? We could give a 13
mm-hmm.
and a 17-year-old like a gambling game and say like, how much will you be willing to gamble in this, you know, situation? And yes, we will pay out the real money, right? Like how,
mm-hmm.
What is the, that's where experimental research holds access to risk constant and then can ask like, so are you opting in or not opting in? And I think there's a variety of patterns in research in the sort of data that come out that overall do suggest that adolescents are more willing to engage in sort of risky, mostly like financial gambles and risks that we can easily manipulate in the lab and offer to a person without any sort of health-related harms. That yes, adolescents are more willing to do that, but at what particular age I think is a little bit up in the air still. And I would also just mention a single data point that I think is sort of powerful through a meta-analysis, which compiles like many results of other studies, which shows that children are equally likely to take risks as adolescents in these
mm-hmm.
contrived sort of gambling like mostly scenarios. And so whether children and adolescents would do so through the same underlying reasons and mechanisms is a very interesting open question. But it seems that these risky behaviors diminish in the laboratory settings into early adulthood.
You and I have talked about how even when you do see a change in brain activation over time, it's sometimes difficult to interpret what the directionality means. So let's
yeah.
say reward response in the brain goes up with age. So you might look at that and say, okay, more brain activity means they're more sensitive to reward. But when you're doing something like learning to play an instrument or engaging in any novel task, you're going to see more blood flow because it's more difficult. Whereas as you attain mastery, you actually see less brain activity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. And when we think about what we can measure in human brain imaging, the bold signal which is an indirect measure of neural functioning, it really does boil down to how much oxygenated relative to deoxygenated blood is flowing in a particular brain area. And that's actually, it is a proxy, it's thought to be a proxy for brain activity. But we can also think about brain activity as related to energetic efficiency. So like you said, as we become skilled and practiced in a certain behavior, the brain can quite easily habituate its signal and achieve the same behavior with sort of less energetic investment, if you want to think of the bold signal as sort of indirectly related to that. And so, you know, it's for things that we're very practiced at, we would expect brain activity to be diminishing over time, like you said. So having a sort of strong bump of brain activity to reward, that indicates that reward system in the brain would be sort of using up quite a bit of energy to represent that reward signal. And we can also think about that then as offering like a strong signal that can propagate to other brain systems to guide behavior. And so in a sort of straightforward interpretation of that would be strong bold signal means a very like robust coding of the signals related to those rewards, which then can signal to other brain systems with stronger, stronger signaling properties to, for example, guide physical actions or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's like I just sort of strung together like a three-level levels of abstraction, right, beyond what we can actually measure in human brains. And so I think when we talk about brain imaging, we have to remember that this is a theory or an idea of what it might mean to have strong brain reactivity, but it doesn't necessarily, we haven't necessarily worked out a very precise understanding of what exactly it means. I'm offering an interpretation when I'm doing that.
Every single thing we're talking about has like all these many complex layers. I'll throw in another one. So when we're talking about risk and reward, there are sex differences that we see there. Mm-hmm. So the stereotype is that teenage boys are the ones who take more risk, and that's definitely reflected in the data in at least some areas of risk taking. Mm-hmm. And I can think of at least three different reasons that might be the case. So one, if you're looking for a more biological explanation, there's some research that talks about testosterone modulating dopamine function in the brain. So maybe mm-hmm. males having more testosterone during puberty is increasing reward sensitivity in this very basic neurobiological way, and that leads to differences in behavior. A second theory would be more on the female side, which is saying that girls go through puberty earlier, so their brain is maturing faster, and for other sorts of reasons, maybe hormonal reasons, they experience more anxiety and inhibition. So it could be something like same reward signal, but more inhibition in females. Mm-hmm. So males just seem riskier by comparison. And then a third one, the nurture element, would be something like due to socialization and cultural norms, mm-hmm. maybe boys are more encouraged to take risk or girls are less encouraged. And no doubt all three of those and more plays a part. But let's open that up for discussion.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, there's, you know, when we think about the cascade of puberty, there's quite a bit, there is, you know, hormone, like the root of that is changes in hormones. And there are overlapping hormonal changes between males and females, but there's also very, very strong differences in the concentrations of the hormones and the age trajectory along which hormonal cascades of puberty plays out. And so we can think of male and female puberty in some regards as maybe two sides of the same coin, but on the other hand, as like kind of fundamentally different. And this is where sometimes researchers struggle to decide, if we're studying puberty, do we lump males and females together? Do we do separate and parallel analyses on each sex separately? It's really tricky to decide, and part because is it a qualitative or quantitative difference between male and female puberty? And how that then entrains the brain is a sort of interesting related question. I think we have a pretty rudimentary understanding in that so far, at least in humans. And I'll also just add, and this is more of a pragmatic how the science gets done in the background kind of stuff. Measuring hormones in females is much more complicated than in males because of cycling effects related to the menstrual cycle, because the females have an overall sort of baseline shifts over over long periods of time as a product of pubertal transition. But then layered on top of that are the sort of monthly cycles that begin during puberty and that have their very own hormonal cascades. And so this has led actually many researchers to try to just avoid studying females and hormones in the first place, although the NIH and other large funding bodies no longer will be happy about that. They kind of really, really push people to study both sexes, including animal researchers, though it's much more inconvenient and tricky to do, because otherwise the research would only generalize to half the population, which is not from a health, you know, if you're a funder that's interested in health as the root cause of why we fund basic research, it should apply to everyone, not just half of the population, unless you have a really good reason to restrict it. But in any case, I mean, I think on one hand, it's kind of remarkable how the different hormonal cascades that do exist for males and females sort of, I think it's fascinating to think about the ways that they may exert differential impacts, right, on male and female behavioral development. I also think, though, that it's kind of remarkable how similar we end up after all of that, spite of the fact that that hormonal profiles are quite different across the sexes. But something that researchers in this area really have to pay attention to are both whether the research questions that are being asked apply equally to males and females, whether the measurements of hormones are skewed toward, you know, male versus females sort of having more dramatic effects. Testosterone is probably the most commonly measured hormone in this research, but it has many, many orders of magnitude larger of change in males than females. And so is what we're learning about testosterone more applicable to males? Like, these are all the kinds of really tricky questions that live in this space and make researchers have to think really hard about what it is they're trying to understand and whether and how it applies to males and females.
This is a good place to bring up the distinction between organizational and activational effects on brain development. So as you mentioned, with hormones, there could be quantitative or qualitative differences that produce these sex differences. So one might be just there's a main effect where males on average have much more testosterone than females, but we can assume that testosterone by and large has the same effect on human brains. So if you were to control for that, you get the same effect. And then the alternative explanation would be something like per unit testosterone, it has different effects on different sexes. And that might not be even an inherent thing. It could have to do with the way our brain is organized due to prenatal hormone imbalances, or not imbalances, but naturally occurring sex differences.
Yeah, things got really hairy and interesting in this space. I mean, if we think more foundationally about what hormones might be doing to develop a brain, during puberty, the concentrations of hormones are rising, right? And that some are rising at dramatically higher, you know, sort of in dramatic ways where, so a question is sort of, is what puberty is doing to a developing brain, is the way it's operating simply the existence of higher concentrations of the hormone? Like, is it just that we went from having very little testosterone to very much, right? And that if we were to reduce that amount, then something about brain function would revert to like a different state? Or is it that the introduction of hormones at these changing concentrations is actually exerting a more permanent impact on sort of sculpting and shaping the brain through plasticity? In that case, if we took that testosterone or what have you away, the brain would remain in whatever state, you know, the system developed it into. And I think both types of effects exist, right? We know this for certain, that the brain has both these long-term permanent effects of hormones and also has effects of the sort of dose dependence of the state that the brain is in at that time depends on the hormone concentrations it has. But the vast majority of research that guides what we know about this is, again, comes from animal research. And so I think teasing apart what's organizational and what's activational in humans is a very uncharted path.
We've talked about two steps of our research process. One is something like, what actually happens that changes brain, the brain during development. And we talked about hormones as one, but certainly not the only effect. And then there's a next step of, given certain brain changes that occur, how does it relate to behavioral changes? And we talked about reward motivation and risk taking. And again, there's all sorts of other areas which we didn't get to. But a big next step from that is, given that there are these quasi-causal effects of genes and environment and all these influences on brain development that lead to changes in behavior, where's the room for free will in that? And I know that you've been involved in some consulting in the legal space of not only thinking about how different effects lead to differences in brain development that lead to differences in behavior and where's the sort of room for moral judgment in that, but knowing that brain development continues well beyond age 18, but in our legal system, 18 is seen as sort of this hard cutoff where you are a fully responsible as adult, and the science seems to be heading in the direction of that is an assumption that, that we might have leapt to too quickly.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think a really interesting implication of research on brain development, which largely across the last couple of decades has been extremely straightforward and clear that brain development is not complete at age 18 at many, many levels, and that that influences a person's behavior. Juxtaposing that with the legal space in which an 18-year-old is treated like an adult, starting on their 18th birthday, right? And sometimes even starting earlier, depending on different what kinds of sort of criminal contexts there is. I'm referring to like sort of younger people being waved up into the adult system at lower ages. And in some states, by the way, there's no minimum age. It could be a 10-year-old, depending on what crime they committed. There's a movement, I guess, advocacy that exists that is attempting to place a developmental context within the legal system and thinking about what kinds of punishments might be appropriate for individuals who commit crimes at young ages. Now, nobody is suggesting that individuals should not be responsible for their behavior in some way. We don't have a free pass, like a get out of jail free card, right, for people who may have committed really horrible acts. That does happen. But at the same time, we know quite a bit about the developmental state of an 18-year-old and how it's different from, let's say, a 30-year-old or a 40-year-old who commits a crime. And many scientists, I think, are interested in making sure that whatever societal systems exist that govern punishments for crimes should factor in some way, at least respect the fact that that individual existed in a developmental stage that makes them different in certain ways. It also kind of comes to, there also are arguments that come down to what our justice system is for in the first place, and if it's for deterrence, or if we're choosing to punish individuals as a product of the likelihood of them continuing to be a burden on society or being dangerous or committing crimes in the future. We also know that the individuals who commit crimes as adolescents are less likely to become lifelong criminals than an individual who is committing crimes later in their lifetime. So in other words, the rate of recidivism or sort of continuing a lifetime of committing crimes is much, much less likely for an adolescent offender. And so if our justice system is supposed to be protecting sort of public safety, exerting a strong punishment on a young person who commits a crime, having them out in the world is less unsafe than having the same a person who committed the same crime later in life. And so some of this gets very political, right? It depends, and also philosophical, of like what is the justice system and punishment and incarceration for? And so where this really comes into play is in sentencing decisions, where judges have leverage in deciding how long an individual ought to be punished for a particular behavior. it's not whether or not the person did it or didn't do it. That's a question for a whole different sphere. But given that a person may have been found guilty of doing something, what is an appropriate punishment? And that there's a lot of in our system, that's mostly determined by there's a lot of discretion allowed for judges, and so much of this sort of translation of research findings to this sphere is educational work for judges to help judges understand the unique context behind behind an individual who may have committed a crime as a young person.
What would it look like to live in a world where people have this more nuanced, continuous perspective of brain development?
Yeah, well, I teach a seminar class here sometimes about like growing up, basically, is like the theme of the class. And it really, something that we come away with is the idea that development is, first of all, a lifelong trajectory. There's no one day that you wake up and you're like done, right? So it's sort of a misconception in the first place to think that we achieve maturity at one particular point of our lives. Also, of course, there's a lot of variability across people and when it happens. Mm-hmm. So we can think maybe of instead of maturity as an ongoing process. And something that we wrestle with in this seminar that I teach is that that's all well and good if you're a sort of nuanced scientific thinker that doesn't need to make like policy decisions. But as soon as you have to translate this sort of ongoing trajectory of maturity into like policy, you have to provide like black and white rigid guidelines mm-hmm. of when, let's say, when should a person be allowed to, and you could insert here, like drink alcohol, vote, join the military, get married, be responsible for their own healthcare decisions, you know, be treated as an adult in criminal contexts. Live on one's own, rent a car, rent a house. Like, mm-hmm. you can just go on and on of when should a person be allowed to do something. And this is where the sort of rigid policy guidelines need to be really straightforward in order for a large-scale society to follow them. But that's a very, very different than what actually happens psychologically, which is this sort of slow and steady ongoing process. And we rest in this seminar that I teach, we wrestle with the points of disconnection between those two things. And we often try to like brainstorm of like, well, okay, imagine a world where we've solved this and we've taken away the points of disconnection. What would it look like? And, you know, it looks like a world without policies, like, which is impossible / probably certainly has its own problems. And so I think there's no perfect answer to this question, but having a respect for the difference between the needs and challenges of policymaking versus science, I think like understanding that there is a divide there based on the goals of the system you're talking about really underscores why it's so hard to reconcile.
We've covered a lot of ground today. Thank you very much for your time, Leah.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.